Luther took it down like a verse from the Bible coming true. After losing everything, you could hear the hammers ring as they built it all up again. The mill wheels turned, they kneeled in church, washed of all their sins. But the river always wins. I come down from the mountain like judgment from on high, going home to the ocean, and I don't give a damn about the dreams of men.
It's Chuck from Above the Basement, Boston Music and Conversation, the official podcast partner of the Boston Music Awards. 2017 sees the Boston Music Awards celebrate their 30th anniversary on December 7th at House of Blues in Boston. Tickets are open to the public and on sale now via the Boston Music Awards website at bostonmusicawards.com. The night will feature multiple live performances from nominated artists, and winners will also be announced that night, so if you want to see who wins firsthand, make sure you grab tickets. Before we start, I want to do a little housekeeping. Some of you may have noticed a big push on our social media. We are trying to reach as many ears and eyes as possible, and we rely on our listeners to help spread the word. So be sure to visit us at AboveTheBasement.com to hear all our episodes. We also have videos of some live performances from our guests and some really fantastic photographs taken for you to peruse. Please subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher, and also we'd love if you would leave us some 5-star reviews. In addition, invite all your many friends to like our page on Facebook. Just go to our ATB Facebook page and click Invite your friends to like. You can also subscribe to our mailing list from our page and from our website. We depend on our listeners to help us let everyone know about all the wonderful guests we have on Above the Basement. All right, so singer-songwriter and teacher at Berklee College of Music, Susan Cattaneo switched gears towards a life in music after finding a sign in the cracks of a sidewalk. There's a song in there somewhere. She then took the big leap to join the amazing music community of songwriters in Boston. A well-respected songwriter with numerous awards for her music, her songs have been described as New England Americana with a twang. She just released her latest album, The Hammer and the Heart. Jonathan Beakley sat in with me this time around, taking Ron's seat while Ron is currently on a brief hiatus in October. We'll have a few more episodes this month with some guest co-hosts. Okay, so here is our conversation with Susan Cattaneo, recorded at Woods Hill Table in Concord, Massachusetts. So yeah, Jonathan has co-hosted several times. Who have you co-hosted with?
So Ali McGurk, and then when we were at the Music Emporium.
Andy Cambria.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You know Andy?
Sure.
Yeah. So we talked to him at the Music Emporium, which is
nice.
Yeah, so we've done
a beautiful place.
And the best one, of course, I interviewed the Butler Frogs.
Oh, yes. That's my band.
The Butler Frogs?
That is Chuck's band.
Yeah, we're
Chuck.
The band. Yeah, I know.
Awesome. What genre?
I don't know. You interviewed us. What genre are we?
The Butler Frogs are primarily, or at least initially, were a cover band, but now they have an album of originals.
Actually, that's not true. Did you even listen to the podcast?
I was there when it was made.
We initially had our own music that we brought in.
Yeah.
And then just to get gigs, we just played stuff.
Right.
And then we got lazy and we just ended up being a cover band for a while. And then, but we just went into Woolly Mammoth, which I know you've been in.
I have.
And the great Sir David Minahan produced us. And we have a EP coming out in the late 29th century. If we finally get our act together.
Good.
It's all mastered. It's just, we just haven't put it together.
Wow. Yeah, I'd love to hear it.
Yeah.
What do you play?
I play guitar.
Nice.
Yeah. Well, you know, it depends on who you ask. Chuck can hold a guitar.
Yeah, I do.
Whether
that
he can play it is a whole other story.
He's very good. False modesty.
Shucks. And he plays the drums.
And I play the drums. So when
are you interviewing us? Are we interviewing
him?
Yeah. What the heck?
Oh my God. The tables have been turned.
I know.
Quickly. No.
So I'm not their primary drummer, but when their drummer, Greg, who's fantastic, can't make it, I sit in.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for coming out here, although you come out here a lot because you're. your kids go, both of them? How many kids do you have?
I have two kids.
And they both go to CA?
One of them is now in college, but yeah, they both went through CA. I have one who's a junior, and then my mom lives here. So I am in Concord Academy, and it Concord a lot.
So you're originally from New Jersey.
I am.
Is it northern New Jersey?
Yes.
Because I lived in New Jersey, in New York, New Jersey for about 20 years.
Where'd you
live? I lived in the city in Brooklyn.
Oh, nice.
And then I moved out to Maplewood in the Short Hills area.
Nice.
And we were there for like, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 years, something like that.
I'm a little further out. Further
west.
From the Short Hills area, so.
It must have had an effect on you because your label is called Jersey Girl Music, right?
Well, yes, but that is after the Tom Waits song, which I absolutely love. And I like the Tom Waits version of it more than the Springsteen version. The original one is cooler.
You've lived a lot of places, right? So you've got Jersey, you were in New York a bit, you were in Nashville for a while, you spent your summers in Arizona.
California, Italy.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
So is there one particular place that had an effect on you on the music that you make?
Very much so. And it was Arizona.
Arizona. Interesting.
It's funny because I spent my summers there because my uncle had asthma and couldn't survive on the East Coast.
Huh.
So he actually was shipped out and was raised on a ranch in Arizona.
Oh, wow.
So every summer we would go out to be with my family. When I first heard kind of southwestern country music, we're talking old style country music, I remember thinking, oh, I just don't like the pedal steel sound. And it's funny because that totally became like something that I loved.
Well, you know, you were young.
I was.
Well, it must have made a huge impression. So I was listening to your song In the Grooves, right? And not only is this song in the style of Americana, you know, rockabilly, this kind of thing, also the lyrics are basically an homage to that kind of music.
So, yeah, like an old style.
Yeah, so it must have had an effect on you.
Yeah, but also that song in particular was a co-write with my friend Bill Kirchen.
Bill Kirchen.
Who is with Commander Cody.
You introduced me. I mean, you didn't actually
introduce
me.
Did I introduce
you? But you,
I should've.
It was because you were on stage with you. That was my introduction to
him.
Oh,
yeah. He is wonderful.
He's amazing. You should see this guy.
I saw it on the video.
Yeah.
He was killing it.
And I knew I was going to do a co-write with him. And so I actually brought the lyrics to that song to the co-write. When I'm a co-writer, especially if I'm working with an artist like that who's so clearly defined, has a specific sound and a specific thing that he does, I try and kind of accommodate my writing to that. And In the Grooves came out of it, and then I ended up covering it, which is really awesome. It ended up being on my album.
I kind of did my little extraneous research on him because he's an interesting looking guy.
Yeah.
He's so amazing looking up on stage. Plus, he can kill on the guitar. He's just amazing. But then I discovered he's like, they call him the father of something that
Titan
bands
of
like
the Telecaster?
But he started like a genre of music. It was in the wiki for him that kind of influenced Wilco and a lot of those other
bands.
Yeah,
he was like alt country before it was cool to be
alt
country.
What's he doing in Boston?
He's not in Boston. He's in Austin.
So he just happens to be up here a lot, I guess.
Well, I actually went down to Texas and worked with him. And then when we had two songs on the album that we wrote together,
and he
was touring through, I'm like, come and do my CD release with me. He's awesome.
Yeah, he's great. You got to see him. I saw Thunder Road is when I saw him.
Yeah, he's so good. And so nice. The nicest, most humble, famous person I know.
That's refreshing.
Yeah.
That's very good.
You drop the needle on a 45. Watch as the whole world came alive. Round and round the music sparked to the beat, beat, beat of your vinyl heart. You gave Elvis Presley his blue suede shoes, James Brown all of his stylish moves. The turntable spoke the gospel truth.
You recently completed not just an album, a double album. So,
yes.
You know, there are a lot of people who say that the album as a medium is dead.
Right.
And you doubled down on
it. I did.
So why is that?
I didn't start out to do a double album. It was just going to be a single. I was just going to do an album. That was the thing. I was like, well, I don't care. I'm bucking the trend. I still believe that the album as an art form allows you to tell a bigger story.
Mm-hmm.
I teach songwriting at Berkeley, and I have a lot of young students, and they're all about the single. You know, you get the single out, and I'd like to tell a bigger story, and an album allowed me to do that. So I started recording, and I produced it myself, and I thought it'd be really cool because I like collaborating with a lot of different people in a lot of different areas. And,
yeah, we're going to get into
you know,
that.
Yeah.
And I asked them all to be on the album with me, so they're like 41 musicians yeah. on right. this album.
You're basically Steely Dan, aren't you?
I know.
Right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. A country Americana version of Steely right. Dan. I started to record the album, and then I had too many songs, yeah. and I had too many people that I wanted to work with. And I suddenly, as a joke, I was doing a show at Cafe Lena in New York State. And I said, yeah, I'm going to do a double album. And I thought, oh, I am going to do a double album. And it split so beautifully into like a rock album and then an acoustic side.
Yeah. So tell us the name of the album and how that name corresponds to the parts, right?
So, yeah. So what happened is that I needed to write a manifesto for this album. And it turned out to be this song called Work Hard, Love Harder, which is about like loving
That's the
your
first
life.
Song on the album, right?
It's the first song on both albums.
Okay. Yes.
So I did a rock version of it okay. with the Bottle Rockets, and then I did a folk version of it with the Boxcar Lilies. The album was going to be called Work Hard, Love Harder. And I thought, oh God, I hate that title. It's like, what does it look like? It's like me in like a Rosie the Riveter outfit, like thumbs up, like woo, you know? And I just did not like that at all. My husband, who is a creative and wonderful person.
He is. Just looking over there, looking all wonderful.
Thank God. Thank God for him. He's like, okay, don't freak out. But what if we came up with a visual for Work Hard, Love Harder? Yeah. So maybe there's like a hammer and then a heart. And I was like, oh, it's going to be called The Hammer and the Heart. So I owe everything to him for that title. Because The Hammer is such a great title for the rock side, and The Heart is for the acoustic.
Yeah. You had a
well done, Dina.
A previous album that also had Heart in it, didn't you?
Or, yeah, yeah. Oh God, yeah. I know. Yeah, I have the one right before this one.
Haunted Heart
Haunted Heart. So.
So there are some trends in your music because I noticed you had a song called "Worth the Whiskey," and then you have one called "Whiskey into Tears." So there's definitely a pattern.
Yes.
There.
Which is surprising because I don't drink.
You don't? Not at all.
No.
Okay.
Okay. But you know, I think that especially whiskey. To Tears was one that, you know, alcohol is a wonderful construct to work with in songs mm. because alcohol makes you lose your inhibitions. It also leads you down a bad path. It also leads you down a good path. So it's a wonderful vehicle. And I used to drink, but it's more the fact that when I drink now, I'm like fun for about 3 minutes and then I have to go to bed. So... So I just don't.
So I read that this album tells the story of how you went from almost giving up to rediscovering the joy of making music.
Yes.
Can you? That sounds very personal. But
well, I guess it's all been kind of a path for me. I started out my career as a songwriter writing for Nashville. That is a certain kind of songwriting that I really loved because it's very craft focused. And I love language and I love the process of language. It's like a puzzle. Songs are like puzzles, and I like to put them together. But I definitely felt that there were times when I would change a lyric or adjust a lyric to service the genre that I was writing for.
Right.
I wasn't writing for myself. And then I came out with Haunted Heart, and that was the first album that I wrote for myself. It was incredibly freeing, but also it was a really dark album. There was an incident that happened to me that kind of was the catalyst for that, which I'll tell you about in a bit. But
is this the Lorelei song?
No, that's
oh my God, because that one is so. I felt like I needed a glass of whiskey.
Well,
after
yeah, that's a whole nother thing. But so yeah, so Haunted Heart was my opportunity to like let all the skeletons out of my closet all at once. I wanted this album to reflect what my live show is more like, what I am like as a person. Hmm. Because I'm not all about the sadness. You know, you have some songwriters who that's really what they do. They do the sad songs really well. And I have a lot more variety.
Well, it came out of, I mean, if you want to talk about it now, you came out of a very traumatic time.
That
event that happened to you.
Yeah.
I know you've talked about it before, but if you want to.
What happened is that I had just finished an EP for the pop country market. I became a pop country artist.
Sweet.
And I was down in Nashville and I was talking like this and I was using like a southern
oh, really?
Accent. And I thought, I am pretending to be someone else and not from New Jersey, you know?
Yeah, but that happens. When I go to England, not that I've been there many times, I start talking in an English accent.
Yeah.
I don't
exactly.
know what it is.
Exactly.
It just kind of wears on you.
I know, right?
And you sound better.
But you're
anyways.
An actor too, right?
Yeah, that's true. I don't know if you knew
Madonna
that.
Madonna does that as well.
She right?
I know she does.
Yeah.
She
right?
does.
Guy Ritchie, the whole thing. Anyway.
But so I had this. I had this EP that was really like every single woo, like it was like a country thing. I was going to sing this song and the whole, it hadn't even gotten unpacked from the boxes yet. And it was Christmas time in my house. And unfortunately, a friend of mine fainted headfirst down into my kitchen from the stairs. Headfirst onto the floor. And I happened to be right there, and she crushed her neck.
Oh,
and pretty much almost coded out on my kitchen floor. Yeah. Oh, my God. I'm doing CPR, and I'm trying to like save her life. I'm home with like my little kids, 6 and 8 year old children. And it was very gruesome and very, you know, there was a lot of blood everywhere. And luckily, I called immediately, so the EMTs came really quickly, and the police came to my house, and they said she was going to die. You know, I just have never experienced anything like that in my life. And
how many people have?
I had like what I would call a mild version of PTSD for about 6 months after that, where like I would come in, and you know, my husband would be asleep on the couch, and I would be like, oh, he's dead. And when I came out of it, I could not write that pop country stuff anymore. I just couldn't do it for myself, authentically. And so I was like, you know, screw it. I am just going to write everything that I ever wanted to write about. And I don't care if the language is slightly maybe intellectual and well-constructed. And, you know, like I'm not going to countrify it just because that's what I'm writing for the market. I'm not going to write for the market anymore. I'm just going to do my own thing. And that was Haunted Heart that came out.
Okay.
The wild thing is that after spending so many years chasing the dream of, you know, success, Haunted Heart was the one that got me the most success. That was the one that I've won all the awards for, and that was the one that really kind of set the path for who I became as an artist.
Was that was really kind of the first time you had your own voice in the music there?
Yeah. And as a teacher, you know, how many years have I been telling my students, write your truth? I never wrote my truth, ever. And it took this really traumatic thing to happen to me to make it so that I was forced to become who I became.
Well, I'm sure it was therapeutic for you as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there, Lorelei in particular, that song, I had a friend who stole something from me. I thought I could get over it for like 2 years. And once again, my husband was like, can you just write a song about it? I thought, okay.
Get it out of your system.
I'm going to write a murder ballad.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
And I'm going to kill them off in the song. And that's going to make me feel really good.
Yeah. So, I mean, the lyrics are pretty
they are
intense. It's crazy.
And what's crazy is that, and this is terrible, but I will tell you, like, the person who that song is about, if they ever heard that song, they would know that it's about them. So,
you know, it's funny because Jeff Tweedy, I remember reading an article about him where he said that some of the scariest songs he ever heard were as a kid, those Appalachian songs, where it was like a happy song about murder.
Right.
And it scared the crap out of him. I mean, he actually has a couple songs about that.
But there's something, I love the idea of like skipping gaily through the minefields.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because I think that it's in a major key and it's up tempo. People are like, oh, I like this song. Oh, what's it about? You know, like,
let's talk about your teaching. So you teach songwriting at Berkeley, right?
I do.
Do you know Bonnie?
Of course I know
Bonnie's
Bonnie.
Awesome.
I cover one of her songs on my double album.
Oh, which one?
Backdoor Slam.
Oh, wow.
It's such a good song.
She's great.
Oh my God.
She's
such
great.
A good song.
You have described yourself as a songwriting geek.
Yes.
Yes. Does that correspond to the writing of the lyrics, or is it about the construction of the entire song?
I think it's about the construction of the whole song. Yeah. I mean, I have to say, so I'm not a huge chordsmith, so you're not going to find me like, you know, I'm going to the subdominant of the 5 with the 7 with the sharp 4. You know, that's not my thing. So I'm really a lyricist. So for me, it all connects kind of to melody because I'm a singer and to the lyrics. But I do love the relationship between chords and melody. We have a thing at Berkeley called prosody. And prosody is when the music matches the lyric content. An example would be, I got friends in low places. Low. The word low is on the lowest part. But we also teach that you can make the song structure support the meaning of the song as well.
Yeah.
And I find that part really cool. Like I'll put a melody in that I know will make you comfortable or I know will make you uncomfortable. Like I have it all in my control to do that.
A lot of your lyrics are the telling of stories.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that some types of music, some genres of music are better for telling stories?
Oh, sure. I mean, I think that if you have a great singer, great bass line, great groove, great guitarist, the lyrics are, I wouldn't say they're less important. They're just not really the focus of that kind of song.
But do you feel that there's something about country music, say, that lends itself to telling a story that, say, progressive rock doesn't?
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's certainly the tradition of country music that came about. If you look to like cowboys and the fact that they would tell their stories around the campfires. So the songs were kind of part of that experience as well. It depends on what the purpose of the song is. Because there are some songs where it's like, I don't really care. It just makes me want to dance. Then there are other ones where I want to be drawn in. I want to create a landscape for you to see.
I go through these empty days, out of tune and out of place, since we've gone our separate ways. I hold another's heart, thought I'd made a brand new start, but when the memories fall like rain, you're a feeling I can't shake. I just fade to blue, steal away inside. Just fade to blue, lost without you.
I want to back up in just a second, but before I back up, I'm just going to back up a tiny bit. When you went to Berkeley, you went as a, you were a songwriting major.
I was a vocal performance. I went on a vocal scholarship.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's
and
right.
Then
okay, I'm sorry.
And then took my first songwriting class and then became like a songwriting major.
And you started teaching right out of graduation, is that correct?
Yeah.
That's kind of insane, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like I mean, usually don't you have to go out and I don't know. This was late in your career as well. Like you would kind of switch gears and
yeah. So I was in New York and I was a writer producer.
Right.
I made TV commercials and movie trailers and wrote scripts for that. And then I would perform in a band at night.
A cover band or original band?
Originals.
Oh, cool.
But I wasn't really writing. I wrote like two songs for that because I couldn't communicate. I was an ear-trained singer. We moved to Boston and I really wanted to be a musician. I didn't want to just be a singer, the chick singer up front. So I quit my paying job.
Yeah.
And went to Berkeley as a grown-up.
Yeah.
And so I was older than most of the students there. And because I had been a writer, and I'd been like the head of my department at Channel 11 in New York, so I had had experience working with writers and crafting scripts. So in class, I started critiquing people's songs. And then afterwards, they would come to me and ask me if I could help them with the song.
Because you're talking to 18, 19-year-old kids,
right?
So, right.
And,
you know.
And luckily, thank God, my teacher, Pat Pattison, was not threatened by that.
That's cool.
Because I can imagine that was super obnoxious and hired me.
I'm
right
sure you
after
did it very nicely.
I don't know. So
the whole idea of you quitting your paying job and going back to school for music.
I know.
I want to talk about that brave, that's a great thing. We're always talking about people making these kind of leaps.
I have to tell you, there's a really cool story behind that. So
Tell me.
We lived in Cambridge and I was walking down Prospect Street, God's honest truth. And I was saying to myself, what should I do with my life? I'm not religious, but I was like, God, give me a sign. What should I do with my life? Should I quit my paying job? And it's kind of cool to say you're a TV writer producer, I got to tell you. And then quit my paying job to be a student? Like, what? So I'm walking down the street and I see something shining in between the kind of slabs of concrete on the sidewalk. And I reach down and pick it up and it's a single silver treble clef earring.
What?
Now, having said that, the honest truth is that I was like, if a bird flies over me at any time today, I should quit my job and go to Berkeley.
If I hear a car horn.
Exactly. If a bus drives by you know, I was just looking for a chance to reinvent myself. And wow. I never looked back. It was the best thing I ever did.
And I'm wondering also, with that background in writing for other people and then starting writing for yourself, do those two different types of writing help you approach a student with idea and how to aim them towards getting where they want to go with that song that they're writing?
Definitely. I mean, I think the one thing that was so interesting is that being in advertising, you know, you always have a client. Mm-hmm. What would always happen for me, like a weird analogy, would be like I'd create this beautiful thing and be like, here is my beautiful idea for my client. And the client would be like, you know what? My wife really likes dogs. Can you put dogs into this? And he'd be like, dogs, okay. And then you'd rewrite it and they bring back, here's my beautiful thing. Now it has dogs in it. You know, I think I want cats, actually. Can you make the cats blue? And it'd be like so bizarre, weird changes. So by the end, your final product would be some sort of weird Frankenstein thing.
It's a bastardization of the beautiful thing you initially gave them.
But what it did for me was it completely allowed me to divorce my ego from the process.
I know you've talked about this before, the ego process.
Yeah, and that, if I could give that to my students, I think that's one of the most important gifts, especially because you write a song and you become so attached to it. My friend Steve Seskin has this beautiful analogy. He's like, I think of the muse as this beautiful woman and she's up on her throne. And she's like, oh, look at Steve. He's working so hard. And here, I'm going to give him a beautiful lyric and I'm going to give him a beautiful melody. But guess what? They don't belong together. And I think that that's like great because sometimes the muse gives you stuff and it's not necessarily two things that should be married, even though you got them together. And I think that to be able to teach my students, I call it like to revision, like to re-see something, to see their project and be able to separate it and look at it objectively and think, well, is that really working? You know, because I know that that's really what my boyfriend or girlfriend said, but maybe that's not really a good song hook.
I totally get it when you say ego, because if I write a song and I bring it to somebody without even like listening to the whole thing, they'll be like, oh no, it should go this way. I'm like, no, what are you talking about? I wrote this, I spent a long time on this, this is where it's gonna go. I don't say that, and I'm like, you gotta let go. This is good constructive criticism. I'm talking to smart people who know how to write stuff, so it's something.
But I think it depends on
it.
Who, like for me, I have a very, very small group of people whose opinion I really, really listen to. And I think that when I was younger, you kind of want to get it to everybody. Even with that small group of people that I trust, when they say they don't like something, my initial reaction is like, ugh, I hate you.
And then
I kind of go.
Gut reaction, right?
Away. And
yeah,
then
that's
I come back,
I
I'm like, okay.
Breathe.
Okay, no, that's a good point. Or I understand your feeling, but no, this is the way I'm going
to
do it.
And when I go to these people who are smarter than me, eventually I'm like, okay, you're right.
Yeah.
All right.
I hate it when they're right. It sucks.
Damn it. But I wonder if when a student brings you a song, how much do you let the song breathe? They just play it over and over again. Maybe they gig it out or something like that before you're under time constraints because you're in class and things like that.
If you've written something that you absolutely love that God gave you and you don't want anyone to touch it, don't bring it into class. Because I might teach something. For example, there might be a song that, I don't know, maybe the student hasn't really understood that you can use great action verbs. So I might have them do an exercise to like change up the verbs in their song. And they can just have their song the way they wrote it. But maybe the next song they write, they'll actually be conscious of verbs. So sometimes it's not about the song they're working on right now, but whatever the next project is.
So do you give reading assignments? Is there a certain kind of like literary aesthetic that you're trying to inculcate?
We have books that have exercises in them. I think for inspiration, I'll definitely give them literary things. Like where do you come up with ideas? So, you know, the internet, poetry, movies, books, book titles.
Yeah, they got to read.
Yeah, and you are what you read, and you are what you listen to. So I think that's also something really important to know is like, who are their influences right now? Because if they're listening to Sigur Rós, who is an Icelandic band that doesn't use words, they're not going to probably focus on the lyric because they're more about sonic textures. Or, you know, if they're listening to Leonard Cohen, they're going to have amazingly deep visual, lyrical images in their song and probably not very interesting chord patterns. So it depends on where they are in their in their listening.
Have the classes that you've been teaching, have the kids that you've been working with, what you've been teaching them and what they've been giving back to you, has that changed the way you've been writing?
I think what has happened for me because of the artist career that I'm having now, mm-hmm. which kind of goes back to what your earlier question was, I think I'm more able to kind of step back and appreciate what they're trying to say as people before I jump in and mess with it. Do you know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. sometimes I had this one student who put in a song about her dad and it was very, very personal. And it was so personal that it had things in it that didn't make any sense at all lyrically. But it was such a vulnerable thing for her to bring this into class because her dad had recently passed away. And so I was not going to step on that song at all. I was not going to even, I was just be like, thank you so much for sharing that with us. And then she came to my office hour like a month later and was like, you know, look, I'm playing it out and people don't understand what I'm saying.
Right.
Can you help me with that?
Yeah.
Then I think she was ready
on her
to
own, right?
able, yeah.
But what about on your own writing? Like the feedback that you've been giving them,
yeah.
have you kind of looked in the mirror and been like, you know what, I got to start.
All the time. But I think I've always done that.
Yeah.
I've always been like super self-critical. And I think if anything, seeing them be so vulnerable has made me wanting to be vulnerable as well. I guess that's the thing. And also, I mean, whenever I teach an assignment, I'll try it myself. So I know if it's something works or not because I've used it myself. And that's actually really cool because I'll be like, hey, this worked for me and now you should try it.
Interesting.
So thanks. Everybody has like a different approach to it. And in fact, like I do this whole thing on writer's block because I'm a big fan of discovering how to unblock writer's block.
Sure.
I feel like everybody has three or four roads that they take, the same ones, to get to the song. And sometimes those roads, for some reason, are blocked. And you have to find a different road to approach the song. Some people come up with the song title first, and they sing the melody. Some people come up with the groove of the guitar or the piano. Some people start with drums. I don't know, like Peter Gabriel. There's a really cool bunch of outtakes for his album, So.
Yeah.
Do you know So?
Yeah,
oh, yeah.
It's called So DNA. It's wonderful. And it's essentially how he created the album.
Yeah. You
and
hear
what
different
he does
versions
is
of, this, of those songs.
He'll
right?
build tracks and he just sings like, and then he focuses on the vowel sound, and then that turns into the lyric.
Yeah, David Byrne for Talking Heads would do something similar
where
he would just make sounds with his mouth and then figure the things out later.
Yeah. I can't write like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you ever prescribe a student to go listen to a specific song or album or, you know, I see where you're going with this. Why don't you listen to some Springsteen?
Right.
And maybe that'll help you get out of whatever.
Always. I mean, especially because I have to say that there's so much music available to people that maybe it's almost daunting. But I find that my students, some are diving deep into the catalog of music, but some are not. And I have students that are, I'm like, you should listen to Genesis because you're doing exactly what they're doing and you would really like them.
Yeah. I'd send them all the way back to Cole Porter.
Yeah, right?
Right.
Yeah.
The greatest
Irving
lyricist.
Berlin.
Right. Of all time.
Yeah. Duke Ellington.
Yeah.
Billy Strayhorn. Yeah. And that kind of songwriting, I just am studying and teaching this. So it's really cool that you mentioned that because I'm doing like a survey of popular song styles. And we went back to the classic Great American Songbook.
Yeah.
And, you know, the rhythms that Duke Ellington, for example, introduced into popular music is just somebody could really learn from those.
Yeah. And also, you know, like Cole Porter, not only could he turn a phrase, but also he used alliteration and other things, and everything just fit perfectly within the musical phrase. I don't know.
And didn't feel forced.
Yeah. I'd like to talk about all the collaboration that you're doing.
Mm.
So this kind of feeds into that, you know, letting your ego go. But at the same time, when you are not writing for yourself and you're writing with people, that's a whole different dynamic.
It is. And I feel like in that instance, I liken it to building a house. I am your contractor. My job is to make your house the most beautiful house that you ever dreamed of. And that's different than sometimes I'll co-write for myself with somebody. So that's different because then I'm definitely putting myself into it. But a lot of the time, you know, when I sit down with a writer, I'm like, so what do you feel like writing? If I hear something that they haven't really brought out in their voice, you know, like a really cool range that hasn't been explored yet, I'll be like, hey, why don't we try this? I really let the songwriter take the lead. Like if they have a song title that they really want to write. I'm not going to be like, oh, I don't want to write that, because it's for that artist. Sure. So I will make sure that they're invested in it.
What about the Boxcar Lilies? How does that dynamic work?
So the Boxcar Lilies, we actually just wrote our first song together, and they're not used to the co-writing process at all. So that was new for them. I'm pretty fast, so I think it was, you know, an experience for them to write with me, because we wrote a whole song in like 4 hours. That has been a really amazing trio. I love singing three-part harmony with somebody. My sisters all sing, and my brother, so I come from that.
Didn't you say, I thought you said you were the Von Trapps of New Jersey?
We are. My whole, like, all six of us used to sing around the table. And then my mom would, like, dress us up and march us around, and we'd perform at parties.
So you really were the Von Trapp family.
We really were. She wrote a song that we made a record when I was 5.
Really?
Yes.
Wow, my God.
Is it out there? Do you have
No.
We'll find it. It's got to be somewhere.
Yet.
What was the name of the band?
I'm not telling you.
What was the name of the band?
Google it. It was my family. So
so interesting. It's my understanding that you are going to be resigning. Is this right from the Boxcar Lilies?
Yes. I don't know if you'd heard that. I wasn't sure. The news just went out. So what happened in April of this year, I took a nasty spill.
That's right. That's when I saw you.
First down a flight of stairs.
Yeah, guys, you had a problem with stairs.
Right?
You and your friends.
I know. I have to go and burn
elevators.
Basil.
Stay with
and they're
elevators.
Like, no, it's sage.
Oh, gosh.
So I took this fall and I broke many bones and had surgery.
Is something in your hand or something like that?
It's my strumming hand.
Oh, okay.
And I'm right-handed. So it's my handwriting hand and my eating hand and all that kind of thing.
But if you're going to hurt something, I guess your strumming hand is better than your
That's what they say.
Hand.
Yeah. And I was concussed and I broke my foot and I broke my other hand. It was a mess.
Yeah.
And I think before that accident, I thought, I can do it all.
Because you were doing a lot.
That's
a lot.
The Boxcar Lilies are out in Western Mass, so I'm driving 2.5 hours for the rehearsal, once a week.
Yeah.
And it's like 6 hours of my life. And when my solo career with this double album, you know, it charted. We had the number one song on the folk DJ chart, which is so exciting.
Oh, wow.
And I really
got a lot of attention quick.
I wanted to have the time and mainly the energy to pursue that.
Sure.
And I couldn't do the two full-time careers
and
Berklee. I just couldn't do it. So I'm singing with them through February. February 10th will be our last show. It's terrible because I had to like trade a good for a good. You know, I really like making music with them. I love singing with them. And if they lived closer, it would not be an issue at all.
But you all healed up.
Yeah, well, I had the hardware removed from my wrist.
So what did they had screws
3 weeks
in there or something?
Ago, a plate and screws and thing. And I can't tell you, if we had met 3 weeks ago, I was not doing so well. You know, things were hurting. It was really hard. I was recovering, but every time the weather changed, my arm, you know, was really rough.
Really?
And having the hardware out,
it helped.
I'm awesome.
Oh, really?
I am so amazingly awesome.
No,
I
can't.
I feel great, and I can play the guitar, and I feel like myself again.
That's a relief.
And you can go through the airport now. I think.
I know. I set it off.
Yeah.
In
I
Chicago.
Know. Yeah.
God, that was so really a bummer.
Yeah.
Are you going to tour? Are you going to?
I am going to tour. I love the collaborating, so I'm going to keep co-writing with people. I have an artist who was nominated for a Boston Music Award.
Oh, who? Yeah.
Jenna Lotti.
Oh, okay. I know the
produced
name.
And wrote for her album.
Oh, sweet.
I'm
so
excited.
We are the official podcast partner of the Boston Music
you
Awards.
Are?
So I don't know if
I'm
you know
so
that.
Excited for her. She's awesome and wonderful.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, so that's really cool. And so I certainly hope to produce again because I produced this one myself and I kind of like the producing. I think I'm a control freak, and so it all comes back to like I want to know everything that's going on.
Well, you're scratching an itch, right? That's something that you used to kind of do, right? Back in your old life there.
Yeah, right.
So,
but I definitely want to tour and I want to play out as much as possible. I have a great band, Andrew Jones on drums and Richard Gates on bass, Jimmy Ryan on mandolin, Jamie Walker from the Swinging Stakes on lead guitar, Michael Bean, who plays every pedal steel, electric guitar, lap steel, dobro.
I think I saw some of these people at least at Thunder Road, right?
Yeah, and then Renee Dupuis on keys.
Okay, she was there.
She's
right?
So great.
Yeah. Oh, that's a big band.
It is. And, you know, what's so amazing is that each of those people are artists in their own right. So they know how to play with an artist.
Sure.
They don't overplay. And then they're all so great that I could just have them solo for hours and they're so good.
We had Alistair Mook.
Yeah. Oh, sitting. He was my guitar teacher.
Oh, really?
He's so good.
He's so great. And I really like him a lot. And we're going to be talking to Chris Delmhorst on Tuesday. And these were all people that we saw. Last time I saw you and Dino were at the Sub Rosa at Lizard Lounge.
Yeah.
That's kind of what you were just saying. Your band, they all have their own projects and they all are their own artists in their own way.
Right.
But everyone getting together is pretty magical. It made me think about the Boston community, especially the singer-songwriter one, which I'm more familiar with just because that's what that's more my thing.
Yeah.
It was really special to see all these people kind of just taking a back seat and learning each other's songs. I don't know what it is about having a bunch of musicians playing with you that have their own thing.
First of all, I have the nicest people that I work with. They're lovely and kind and supportive. And I think there isn't ego in the band because they've got their own thing going
on. That's what it is.
And so
I think it's a big part of it. They're like, you know, I'm here for you. I'm here to help you. Whatever you need for me to make you sound good, that's why I'm here. Because I got my own thing, and that's my ego over there.
Right.
You know, the good ego, not the bad ego.
Yeah, no, I get it. And I think they're so supportive. I've learned a lot in the past 2 years of working with them. Stage stuff like, you know, dynamics and what it is to step out, trying to learn like when to play and when not to play. And I think that there is a subtlety that I'm learning from them because they're so
especially with so many people you've got on stage.
God,
right?
They're so good. Yeah.
So where are you playing next?
Were you just at the Iron Horse?
Yeah.
Was this past weekend?
Yeah, Saturday.
Oh, fantastic. How was that?
Great. It was with the Boxcar Lilies.
Oh, okay.
Sold out.
Oh, fantastic.
Two encores. I mean, crazy.
Wow.
Just amazing.
Wow.
Really devoted fan group out there. I'm doing a bunch of Lilies shows because I'm kind of finishing that up.
Yeah.
And then on March 2nd, I have a full band show at the Spire with Chuck McDermott. What's going to happen, because I'm going to take a little bit of time off in January and just relax a little bit.
Yeah.
And then hopefully in the spring, I definitely want to be doing more touring. And then I'm hoping, I'm saying this, trying to make it real, I'm going to tour in Europe, hoping Ireland, England, Italy, because I've toured in Italy before, the Netherlands. I am getting a lot of airplay over there.
Are you really?
The album is doing really well.
That's
over
awesome.
There. And still, like, it's been out since June, and I'm still getting a lot of play. So
it's fantastic.
I'm hoping that works out.
Yeah. Well, will you play some songs for us?
Sure.
We'd love to hear a couple.
All right. I'm playing Work Hard, Love Harder.
All right.
The heart beats louder than the dollar. Shines light in a world gone darker. Draws joy in permanent marker. Work hard, but love harder. Father Time's got a job to do. Punches in his time card, and he's coming for you. You pray to St. Joe for that 9 to 5. You should be harder. Take your life and turn it up louder.
Want to do another?
Sure. I think I want to do Field of Stone. Can I do Field of Stone? When I was 10, the highwaymen broke ground and broke the heart of my hometown. God, what silence was in the rolling thunder of the nighttime trucks. And that rumble in my chest felt just like love. But ooh, you can't raise nothing in a field of stone. And ooh,
Find out more about Susan and where she's playing at SusanCataneo.com. Go to AboveTheBasement.com where you can sign up for our newsletter, listen and subscribe to our podcast, like our Facebook page, follow us on Twitter, and look at all the nice pictures we post on Instagram. We are everywhere. On behalf of Ronnie, Jonathan, and myself, thanks for listening. Tell your friends, and remember, Boston music, like its history, is unique. Above the Basement Boston Music and Conversation is recorded at beautiful Woodshill Table Restaurant in West Concord, Massachusetts. Woodshill Table is honored to have been awarded 3 stars as the most sustainable restaurant in Massachusetts by the Sustainable Restaurant Association. The food is organic and locally sourced, non-GMO, and is absolutely delicious. Chef Charlie Foster focuses on seasonal ingredients and their own grass-fed livestock raised on the farm at Woodshill in Bath, New Hampshire. Go to woodshilltable.com for reservations.